Hey, take a network break. Welcome to episode 56. Grab a coffee and a virtual donut and join us for an analysis of the latest IT news, vendor moves, and new product announcements. We'll separate the signal from the noise, or at least make some noise of our own. I'm Drew Connery Murray, and with me as always are my partners in crime, Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks. And before we jump into this week's news, I want to say thanks to our sponsor, Riverbed. Your work, your business, your productivity, they all depend on the performance of your applications. So let Riverbed accelerate your software-driven enterprise. A lot of interesting news this week. Greg, you picked out something about Teridian.
Yeah, Teridian, which is a new company. They've managed to convince a bunch of people to give them a whole bunch more money, which is a validation, of course, of, you know, we've talked over the last couple of weeks about how the enterprise market seems to be grabbing a whole bunch of funding. Now, the interesting thing about their product is it's another SDN WAN type solution, but instead of just saying this is an enterprise and we're going to run an overlay and do some VPNs and some zero configuration and things like that, this one's actually doing it a little bit differently. Again, they're cloud focused, so they have a cloud platform, but they're also very much aware of the internet backbone, and they map congestion and speed and latency around the globe. And then what they do is they can not only use a VPN to find the fastest path across the internet, they can also use DNS. So what happens is your users out in the field, whether they're desktop or in a branch, will get forwarded into the Teridian backbone and then carried across it in the shortest possible path using DNS or VPN, which is interesting, right? Because that means that you don't actually have to change the client. So some SDN WAN solutions require you to enclose libraries into the edge point. Some of them require you to put a device on the site and then tunnel the traffic through the device. Interesting version of SDN WAN, and they just walked into several million dollars worth of round B funding or something like that, which means somebody thinks it's got legs.
So I think this is the 400th SD-WAN company we're tracking now.
Right. I talked to another one just the other day, yep. Mushroom Networks, that's been around for a while too. Their history is broadband bonding, where you take multiple lines, turn it into one line, and they've turned that over time into a full-blown SD-WAN solution. Only they're another one, kind of like Telari, that's been around for years and gone, SD-WAN's not new. We do all of these things. Come look at our solution. It's actually really cool. So, I mean, there's a lot of them out there.
Yeah, I bumped into another one called eCessa the other day. Same sort of thing. They all do SD-WAN in some way, shape, or form by gathering the traffic and trucking it over backbone. There's so many to choose from. And you know what? There is actual differences between them still. They haven't all got the same features yet. And I imagine they're all pedaling really, really fast to catch up.
There's another startup, the name of which I've forgotten. They're still in stealth, but they promise to they have kind of a similar promise to Teridian, where they're saying we can optimize traffic across internet links. So rather than, hey, we're just going to send it to the internet and we're not going to really optimize between the endpoints, as long as the path in a general sense within the context of the overlay looks good, they'll actually optimize between endpoints, and it's all very secret, hush-hush, how they're going to do that. But so this optimizing traffic between internet points when, in a general sense, there is no internet engineering that, in a standard way that will handle that for you. Hmm. There's companies that are trying to come up with answers here for this, like Teridian.
Yeah, we've talked to ThousandEyes, and they map out the internet, and they can see it move. Well, if you do the same, what Teridian and, you know, Telari and VeloCloud and those companies are doing is they're actually saying, well, now we can calculate the fastest path across the internet. So we'll get your traffic and make sure it passes in our tunnels over those fastest paths.
So I'm curious what you guys think about, there's so many companies now, and a lot of the folks who would, you know, buy some of the startups to take them off the table are rolling out their own products already, Cisco, Riverbed, Silver Peak. How long is this investment going to keep up in all of these companies?
Well, so a comment I want to make here, Greg had said earlier, you know, hey, Teridian got a bunch of money, and, you know, implicitly it's kind of a validation. And I don't think that's really true. I think there's just silly money out there, and these venture capitalists have no idea what to do with it all. So when they hear something that seems to look good, they're throwing money at it, because logically there is not enough market for all of these different companies, because their product overlaps are too much. There's not enough differentiation between all these different folks or everyone to survive. I mean, there's going to be some survivors, I think, because the technology solves a meaningful problem, SD-WAN in general, I mean. but who ends up with really having big valuations and lasting for the long haul. It just can't possibly be that many. I don't know what the venture capitalists are doing. Not just this sector. There's a lot of other sectors as well with the same problem.
Hedging. They're all hedging.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think you've got to understand that there's a lot of WAN plays. So if you look, Cisco's iWAN, they're taking all of their existing features and trying to turn it into a unified thing. So their IWAN strategy says, you know, we've got all these features in our routers, DM, VPN, PFR, SSL VPNs, NHARP, we've got the certificates. You know, if you just use them all properly, you could actually build an SD-WAN, which, you know, to be honest, doing that on a Cisco platform is actually really quite hard, and the orchestration piece is missing. Now, that's not Cisco. I'm sure Cisco's working on it, but, you know, if you've
they
got
are
all those
with
things,
APKM, it's coming.
Yeah, it's coming, right? So I'm sure they're coming, you know, APKM is going to be the thing. And then, of course, you've got Glue Networks who can orchestrate these configurations, and they're doing an SDN-WAN play. Then you've got companies like Riverbed and Silver Peak. Both of those companies were doing WAN acceleration. So you can use your WAN acceleration features and turn it into a WAN overlay network pretty quickly. So you've got these existing companies who are extending their features, you know, working from their strengths into the WAN. And then you've got the other legacy or incumbent players who have been running cloud-based WANs, but hasn't really had the focus, because I suspect most networking engineers didn't think you could do that. Like, there was no buzz around replacing the WAN. Everybody just figured that you buy an MPLS service from a carrier and get ripped off and be happy with that. And now you've got these new players coming in. So you look at what Viptela has done. They've focused on scale. So they're talking about being able to deploy 20 to 50 nodes per day with zero effort, right? You can just roll them out, add them in, boom, away it goes, and then you get the benefits. Or CloudGenix, which is focused on application recognition and, you know, deep packet control. And then you've got these new players like Ceridian coming up who are saying, you know what, the focus here is the actual internet itself and the paths across the internet. So if only you could find the fastest path across the internet, as well as doing some basic packet optimization too, then you could actually improve your data throughput, you know, they claim by up to 20 times. I'm a bit dubious about that, but okay, fine, sure. You know, so everybody's coming at it from a different, you know, it's like there's a hexagon and there's six sides and everybody's starting from one of the points on the hexagon racing for the middle, if you like.
So, Drew, let me be a bit contrarian here and say that I think ultimately, in the long view, the people that are going to win in the SD-WAN realm are the telcos. I think where all of this technology is ultimately going to end up is with the telcos, and two things are going to happen. One is any enterprises, especially big accounts, that are shifting to the internet as their broadband, as their, you know, inter-office connectivity, if you will, and using an SD-WAN solution to help them get there, the telcos are not going to let that go. So pricing is going to change. That's going to cause a price pressure. That's going to change what we're paying today for private WAN and MPLS circuits. It's going to drive that cost down. And I think telcos are also going to want to be able to offer the benefit of SD-WAN technology. And so some of these SD-WAN companies are going to end up bought, perhaps, or being, you know, heavily used by the telcos. And that's where this is going to settle out. I don't think we're going to see long-term too many of these SD-WAN purchases by enterprises, independent things. It's going to all get rolled back into what it was today.
I think I'm going to be a little bit more contrarian there and say I don't think the telcos are going to move fast enough to really get a strong foothold here. Maybe they can buy their way in. I just, based on how they operate, I can't see them. I can understand they recognize an opportunity, but the way they behave, I don't see them moving fast enough.
Yeah, I can see that. I can agree with that in the sense that, but you know what's going to happen is there's a whole bunch of managed service providers who could go and start using this technology over the top of the legacy service providers or the scale, you know, the backbone providers, and do very nicely. If you were a reseller, you could probably do something here. So there's a whole service here around, you know, resellers taking this to the customers, Meraki style. So I could see Cisco going and having Cisco IWAN for people who think that their routers are the only solution to every problem. But there's also a cloud-based WAN solution. You sign up and you've got yourself a cloud-based IWAN solution. So I think
that's a fair point, Greg. You reminded me that VeloCloud caters to that market, the managed service providers for branding and so on.
That's right. So I think there's going to be, unlike some products, which is, you know, your goal is to be bought by big vendor, you know, networking recognized brand name, you know, be it Oracle. Don't forget Oracle's becoming a very big player in this market in the SDN NFV. They want to be, if I can stop laughing long enough. But
if they say they are, and you're going to believe it, mister.
That's right, because if Oracle turns up, they're going to have the only solution in that market. Oracle has a very big thing around SDN and NFV. They see that the database is critical to the NFV, and therefore they own the NFV marketplace, especially for various parts of the market in the carrier market. So there's a whole bunch of different plays going on here. I think the whole SDN WAN, and there's just so much money in that WAN market, so much money, that anybody who can dip a toe in and take out a couple of teaspoons is going to be pretty well off.
All right. Well, we don't want to do the whole show on SD-WAN, but we are sticking to startups making money. A company called Cloudflare last week announced that it raised $110 million, and it's getting it from Fidelity, Google, Microsoft, Baidu, and Qualcomm, along with its existing investors. And Cloudflare, what they do essentially is, like an NFV, they put some traditional hardware functions out at the cloud edge, so load balancing, that kind of thing.
So they're talking about replacing all those appliances that you currently put into your data center in the DMZ, firewalls, security scanning, F5 load balancers, and that type of stuff. Why not just put it into the internet and let them manage it for you? Now, perfectly reasonable. So you know how we just talked about cloud-based SD-WAN? These guys are talking about effectively cloud-based internet services. So instead of buying Amazon's, you know, Route 53 for DNS, or buying a content delivery network, or buying Cisco firewalls or Riverbed, you know, WAN accelerators, why doesn't Cloudflare use their globally distributed multi-data center, software-only, very modern, gripped from the ground up, brand-new methodology to take a slice of that market? And I think that's perfectly viable.
And what's interesting, there's a couple of stories related to this, is that the company CEO feels like his biggest competitor down the line isn't the Ciscos, the F5s of the world, but Amazon, because he sees Amazon starting to offer some of these services too. Mm-hmm. Since they already capture a lot of the enterprise market, then why not add on some network services while you're also getting your compute and storage and so on?
Well, they've got something like 30 or 40 data centers around the internet now. And then they've got this software platform that they've built. Originally, they started off as a caching network, and then they started to add DNS because you have to cache. You can just start to develop more and more features on the top of that engine. And you know what? That's exactly what AWS did. You look at AWS, they started off doing VMs. And then they said, well, we can offer you a DNS service. Oh, you've got all of that. Well, we can do a content delivery network. And the thing is that if you own that platform that people are coming onto, you can see how much traffic is going to other people's CDNs, because you can analyze the traffic. Mm-hmm. And you can go, hey, that's how much money I could make if I built a CDN. You know? Or you can see how much managed DNS services are going on, and you think, I'll build a managed DNS service and I'll take that money, thanks very much. So Cloudflare knows how much traffic is being consumed by the enterprise. They know how much load balancers, how much is F5s, because they can see all that. And they're going, you know what, if I can take 5% of that, I'm going to have a very nice life. And there's absolutely no reason why, especially medium-sized companies, because we used to use Cloudflare before we went to the platform that we went to now, they were giving us DNS, caching, and security, and some analytics. Very simple, all for a very low price, because for them it's just a scale business. They can host thousands and thousands of small businesses and make it work. I can't see how it wouldn't be successful at some level.
You talk about validation. $110 million seems like a lot of validation.
As we said, our operating theory is that there's a lot of cash washing around right now.
I guess that you can't. Yeah, well, there's some amount of overhead that's just pure exuberance in the market as well.
It's got to be spent.
Cloudflare actually exists, though. They have a product. They have customers. So I would say it's not just silly money.
And they have a platform.
Yeah.
So really all they're hiring is developers and maybe some marketing engines to sell. You know, once they develop the product and put it out there, then they can take it from there, sure.
Yeah, so I do agree there's a lot of silly money floating around, but in this case specifically, I don't think there's a lot of silliness there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on to one of Greg's favorite topics, chips. Mellanox acquired EasyChip. Who is EasyChip? I had not heard of them.
EasyChip has been making custom silicon components for routers. So they are, for a very long time, have been the company producing the packet processors inside of Cisco's very high-end routers, the CRS and so forth. And then just recently, Cisco announced that they would no longer be buying any more EasyChip chips, and which left EasyChip's price taking a nasty, nasty hit because its biggest customer just left. Cisco's going to make its own silicon. believe it or not. For its high-end routers, design it from the ground up, Mellanox has come along to acquire them. The market has been a little unfair, I think. The thing about EasyChip is and Mellanox is they're both Israeli companies, so they're both headquartered in Israel. So there's a good cultural fit, very easy to merge them together. Both of them are silicon manufacturers, or they're both in a manufacturing and end-to-end business. So there's a nice tie-up between, you know, Mellanox should be able to bring the EasyChip products into its switching engines and maybe add it to its InfiniBand portfolio and so forth. But the market, the financial news I saw is that soon after this was announced, Mellanox dropped 5 or 10%. People feel that they're overpaying for EasyChip, which is, I can't really make a comment about that, but if you think it's a positive or a negative, I think it's going to be positive, but if Mellanox is overpaying, then it'll take a while to get some value back.
So do you think Mellanox sees an opportunity to become a counterweight to Broadcom, and that's why they're willing to take on this company, even though the company just lost its biggest customer?
I think Mellanox has two businesses, well, three really. It's got an InfiniBand, an Ethernet, and a SFP manufacturing business. So they have a silicon photonics arm that makes the SFPs in 40 gig and 100 gig modules. Adding their chips makes a sense, right? Because they're already into that production niche market, that sort of thing. The question is, if EasyChip's just lost its biggest customer, who's now going to start buying EasyChip silicon for high packet processing performance if Broadcom's taking that? So Avago did a reverse takeover of Broadcom and keeping the Broadcom name. Well, Avago was one of the biggest manufacturers of modules and support silicon for switches. And Broadcom, of course, was making the Trident chipset that everybody's using in their white brand and merchant silicon switches. So, you know, why not? We need more than one. I do believe we need more than one silicon chip in the heart of our switches. We don't want to be dependent like the x86 in Intel.
A couple of Cisco stories. John Chambers, former Cisco CEO, scolding the United States for being the only major country without a digital agenda.
Whenever a CEO says a country doesn't have an edge digital agenda, you can almost bet that within 2 weeks he'll have his hand out saying, we need some money to fund an initiative.
Well, as much as I don't want to impugn on his patriotism, I can see how a digital agenda would be a good thing for Cisco.
Yes, and I can almost point you to the articles where over here in the UK, the Prime Minister of the UK is saying that we want to have more technology startups in the UK, and the French President has said the same thing. Nobody's got a proper digital agenda. How do we make one? And but in this case, when the CEO of a company does this, like it's the same thing with Zuckerberg saying, you know, we need more internet people. We need the H-1B visa cap so we can get low-cost offshore workers to come to the US, right, so I can make even more astonishingly stonking profits for no effort. You know, when these people usually say something like this, I do support him. Every country needs a trend, you know, needs a digital agenda to power their whole countries and move on to adopt computerization and things like that. But, you know, in the US, in a country that still uses the imperial system, he's got a point, I must say. They're still, you know, making bolts and screws in 5/8 of an inch, for goodness sakes, and using fractions on the stock exchange.
Hey. They do have an agenda. It's to keep all the monopolies being monopolies. It's a yeah. It's a strategy that's worked for a long time, and why change now?
Yep. When a CEO says we need a digital agenda at a national initiative, I'm always sitting there going, "Yep, where's the handout? Where's the funding? Where's the special money that I want to get? I'll participate if you give me a couple of billion dollars to fund an initiative."
Yes, you're such a cynic, Greg. You don't think John was being altruistic? Boy, I can't believe that.
Yeah,
you speaking out for the good of America, surely.
That's very funny, Ethan. That's great. Bless you for being so innocent. That's so sweet.
Yeah, unfortunately, the article doesn't really say what that digital agenda is or should be. Why more startups wouldn't necessarily be a good thing, I don't know, but. I guess John Chambers has an idea. Moving on, Cisco just picked up another security services company, this one in the UK called Portcullis, expanding their security services arm.
So we've talked several times in the last few months about Cisco wants to grow its professional services revenue at around about 10% per annum. You're not going to do that by hiring people, and you're not going to do it by H-1B visas either and shipping people in from India and China. So they have to start hiring professional services, and security people are notoriously independent and don't really want to be seen to be working for the man. They did recently buy another company called NeoHapsis, which was also a professional security consulting business. And that's all it is. It's a headcount buy.
I mean, I think it also ties into the trend that we see so much money being spent on security, and services are a nice way to get some of that dollar, certainly.
A little bit. And keep in mind, Cisco Security hasn't been a very successful business unit for many years. You know, they've been through several CEOs or several, you know, heads of that business unit, typically one every year for the last 6 years. They haven't really made the money or the return. It always underperforms compared to the rest of the business. So something has to happen. So hiring a security team of professional engineers to do security consulting to replace resellers is fairly natural for me.
So before we carry on with the show, I just want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Riverbed. We've talked about Riverbed in the past, and our listeners probably are familiar with Riverbed. They've got a platform for providing end-to-end visibility, optimization, and control across an entire enterprise. They deliver visibility, so you can see everything that's going to impact the performance of your applications, whether that be code or the network or the user experience. And when you have that kind of visibility, it means you can find those issues and fix them a lot quicker. They're also into application acceleration, regardless of distance, and they're getting to the SD-WAN market now, so they can steer those apps over the best networks so you get the best performance while lowering your cost. It's all about software-defined IT, whether it's from the cloud to the network. Opens up a new world of options for delivering and controlling applications and data. Riverbed software equips you with the most complete infrastructure visibility so that you can optimize application performance and maximize your business performance. All right, moving on. Ad blocking and advertising and the effect ad blocking is having on the news and content industry. It's been in the news a lot lately. And Greg, I think you picked up the story about Adblock Plus introducing some kind of advisory board to oversee quote-unquote acceptable ads.
Isn't this creepy, right? So Adblock Plus is a plugin that a lot of people are using as an ad blocking tool. So Chrome, Safari, and so forth and so on. And the original promise of Adblock Plus was it's a fork of an open source project called Adblock back in the day. A lot of people use it. It's one of the most popular ad blockers. But do you know what they did? They've actually now started, their way of monetizing it was to go and find good advertisers and put them in a whitelist. So Google pays non-disclosed amount of money so that their ads go past Adblock Plus, mm-hmm. right? Kind of creepy. It's very dishonest, I feel, to produce a product, Adblock Plus, give it away for free that monetizes by not blocking ads when the name is in yours, right? So is the plus the non-blocking bit? Right, you know, we let ads through for money. And originally Adblock Plus was just one guy, you know, like now it's a big, big business thing. It has over 350 advertisers who pay it to whitelist their ads so they go straight through the Adblock Plus. Mm-hmm. What they have now done is announced an independent board to see who is acceptable to pay them money. Do you see any problem with this?
None at all.
You know, they use the term sellout. This has got to be the definition of selling out. When you use your platform to deliver ads or to, well, I guess they're not delivering the ads, right?
When you're
not
building a platform
them.
To block
they're just
ads.
Shy of of delivering ads themselves.
Right. Yes. It's bad. It's like buying antivirus software with approved virus, you know, approved viruses that can go through.
Because some
we don't like your
good.
Malware, but we like this other person's malware.
That's right. So these very fine folks from Russia have met our board's approval. So hope you don't mind being part of a botnet, but it's all good.
What a screwed up position Adblock Plus has put themselves in to get to the point where they think a board is going to help. If you buy a product that blocks ads, that's what it should do. It shouldn't just block some of the ads. And anyway, this is insanity.
It is insanity, although I have to say we as internet users have, I think, bear some responsibility because we want everything for free. And if you want something for free, then one of the ways it gets supported is ads. And then if you start blocking the ads, then the advertisers have to start taking more extreme measures to deliver some ads to you. And the content platforms have to, you know, take steps to figure out is the ad actually being seen. And then you get into the whole ad bot thing going on with manipulating ad page views. So part of it is that our whole system is that, you know, people have grown up expecting something for free, and nothing is free.
I don't think people expect things for free. Like, I come back from 20 years of IT history where everything is paid for, right? Mm-hmm. What has happened is the cost of producing these products has become so cheap that you can give them away for free and still build a business on the back of them. But that doesn't last for very long. When you start, you know, when you have to hire 20 people to keep up with, you know, making money, because you now need to have accounting and a chief and accountant, and you need to have headcount and support staff, right? Then all of a sudden you can't give it away for free, but you've already set the price at free.
Right.
So, and then right the way through the market, people now have the expectation that most things are free. And so look at Facebook. Facebook says everything should be free. Facebook is enormously dominant. People expect things to cost the same as Facebook. Yet the history of IT has been that everything used to cost a mozza. Enterprise IT is littered with expensive products. Look at development environments. Back in the early 2000s, I remember companies spending millions buying Perl compilers and Python development environments and integrated development tools. And nowadays, it's all free. It's open source. You go and use Jenkins and Garrett and GitHub and all those things. Even GitHub is a subscription for a single user is $10 a month.
Facebook free and open source free, of course, are very different. I mean, you say Facebook free in the sense that you're not paying them a monthly fee, and yet you give up everything, and it costs you enormously in terms of your privacy and what you see and how you're marketed to and how your information is used, because you have to give up those rights. It's not a monetary cost. It's a high personal cost, though, but one that's not felt too personally yet for most people. So they're willing to give it up.
That's a nuance. People don't see that, or are
exactly.
Not yet. I was reading some articles this week. I'm sorry, I haven't got links to them, but people in Indonesia say, oh yes, I'm using internet. It's Facebook. And they don't even realize that there's anything outside of Facebook, because the only thing they use is Facebook.
I guess I'm thinking more about content providers, though, like the New York Times, where that is not free to produce, right? You've got to pay reporters and staff, and they've got people all over the world doing very difficult and sometimes dangerous work, and that costs money. And so if they're giving it to you on the internet, then they got to, you know, try to get some of that money back through advertising. That's how newspapers traditionally used to work.
And of course, the elephant in the room is us guys. I mean, we're in the same boat.
That's right. We're in the same boat.
We're not as big of an operation as the New York Times by any means. But yeah, obviously, we've taken a very different tact with our advertising, and we're very upfront about it and all that stuff, not trying to be scummy. But yeah, it's the same. If everybody blocked all our ads and no one supported the sponsored content, we don't exist anymore. It's the way it is.
Right. So, I guess I feel like it's not just one company doing something distasteful. It's a whole system, and the way that system has emerged, that we're getting into these kind of games.
The flip side of it is that everybody who wants to charge you $10 a month.
Yeah.
Well, AdBlock Plus is not $10 a month worth.
Right.
Like, I'm now paying for a whole bunch of things, and I looked at it, and all of a sudden I realized I'm now paying $200, $250 a month in a bit of hosting here, got a DigitalOcean instance for this, got a subscription to this plugin, got this. All of a sudden it starts to add up to, and that's when free plugins start to get really attractive, because you go like,
right.
Remember back in the late 90s, there was all this guff about micropayments, this idea of paying 50 cents a day or 50 cents a month or something like that. Mm-hmm. And at this point in time, the problem actually probably lies with the credit card companies, who still levy like a 30 cent or a 40 cent transaction fee.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the minimum transaction fees are like a dollar. If you make a credit card transaction and pay somebody, whether by debit card or credit card or whatever, they want a dollar for the banking transaction.
Right.
And so
if you're charging someone 50 cents, but it costs you a dollar to process the transaction, you've just
So the real problem is banking. And this is these new banking companies called Square that just fully automate the payment processing and change the way the business, that it could disrupt the financial revenue that they take for what is fundamentally two computers exchanging a bunch of numbers.
Someone shouting, Bitcoin.
It's less about banking and more about payment processing itself. The payment processors are in the middle, are the ones that tend to charge a lot of money to make that happen. I used to work for one.
Yeah, and it's not just a lot of money that they make.
It is an astonishing piles of cash on a day-by-day basis, driven by, on largely a per-transaction basis. It's very low risk for the processors themselves, the way they structure it. It's a fantastic business model.
Be a middleman between two transactions.
That's right.
Rape that money in.
Yeah. So clearly we haven't solved the problem of content on the internet for this show.
But we tried.
We'll come back to that. We tried. We'll come back to that. Carrying on some news, Google and Microsoft were in a long patent fight. There are about 20 lawsuits going on in the U.S. and Germany. It's been going on for the past 5 years. They both announced they're calling it quits. They've reached some kind of agreement. The details of that agreement weren't revealed, but they've decided to call off hostilities, shake hands, and move along. I'm surprised it took them 5 years to get there, because these kind of patent fights can just turn into these awful, bloody World War One kind of slogs where you're throwing resources and resources and resources and you're only moving 5 feet. So I don't know why it took 5 years for them to figure that out.
I wonder how long the Cisco and Arista patent thing is going to drag on. That'd be interesting, because supposedly there's nothing significant going to come out of that particular conflict until the end of 2016, I think, last I heard. So I'd be curious to know if they drag it out and try to, just like you said, a bloody slog like from World War One, or if they'll come to some terms a little bit more quickly and everybody can move on with their lives.
I mean, that's the whole point of amassing a giant IP portfolio, is so that you can, it's mutually assured destruction. But occasionally, I guess, sometimes folks like to lob the missiles because they got those lawyers and might as well make them work for that money.
Well,
what's also interesting, you got Google and Microsoft having patent fights over phones and Xbox, and where's Apple in this fight? Because they've certainly had their share of lawsuits as well. So it's funny. It's like the two people that you don't think of first when you think about phones are fighting with each other. Guys, the target's somewhere else. I wonder if that also factored into this. Why are we what's Microsoft's share of phones? It barely registers.
Right.
So, well, it does now. I think they're kind of – a couple of things strike me here. Google Docs was sort of positioned as a Microsoft killer a few years ago. And in the sense that it would undermine the Microsoft Office business and the people in charge of Microsoft back in the Ballmer and Bill Gates, we're all like, you can't do anything with Office or Windows. You know, that's where the game is. We've got to be pushing Windows and Office, and that's where the money is. And all of a sudden they've realized actually that's not very important. And we know that's true because Office is now on an iPad and can get it on the internet and, you know, all this sort of thing. And all of a sudden the price of Microsoft Office is not $1,000 at retail. It's $120 a year when you buy a Microsoft Live subscription. I do wonder if Microsoft's sort of saying to itself, you know, we actually need to partner with these people. We don't need to be at war with them. And Google's going, we would much rather be putting this behind us and moving on, so let's get used to it. This is a new era. That the actual threat here is Apple or Oracle or somebody else, and this isn't going to win anybody anything.
So maybe Google and Microsoft are going to pool their lawyers into one giant super lawyer to go after Apple.
I don't think so. I just think this made sense 5 years ago.
Because Apple's the other one that it makes sense to partner with, right?
Yep. And back then, Apple and Google were partnered. Apple was using Google Maps. Apple was partnered with Google for all sorts of things. And then Google did things to make Apple upset. So Apple made its own maps happen. And off it went. And now Apple is playing nuclear wasteland at the moment with ad blocking. Which hurts Google right where it hurts. Take your choice. I just wonder if that's what it is. It's like the idea is that these two companies actually need to be partners now, not enemies. And why are these lawsuits running? We can just we're done with it. Let's move on.
That story was about two companies coming to a detente. This story is about one company deciding to start a fight. Amazon has announced that it's going to ban sales of Apple and Google video streaming devices on Amazon.com. If you want to buy Chromecast or Apple TV, you can't buy it on Amazon anymore.
And it's not just Amazon as the seller. It's also anyone using the Amazon storefront can't sell Apple TV either. I read this story I think this morning, and I was like, wow, they're really throwing down hard on this.
Really hard.
Oh, well, it's fascinating. If you think about it, you kind of wonder what plans Amazon Prime has for that streaming business. I am a consumer of Amazon Prime. I don't really use iTunes or any of the other ones, and it is occasionally annoying that I can't get it on my Apple TV, which is a better interface and tends to have better apps than the Roku that I use to consume Amazon Prime. You know, it is what it is. I've kind of never figured, well, of course, they're competitors, so why would one, support the other?
Well, Amazon still gets part of the cut, right? When they sell something, that's the point of being in the middle of the transaction.
They're really throwing down hard here on this. Yeah, they're really, But what does Amazon stand to gain here? If they, what are their next steps? It's not a device play, of course, because Amazon's kind of proven they're not good in the phone business for sure. And I don't know how much command of the market the Fire tablets and so on have. But I don't think it's really, putting a dent in iPads particularly. It's not my impression anyway. And a Kindle isn't really a competing device. It's a different sort of a thing if it's the pure play Kindle that is there for books with the e-ink screen and so on. All you can look at it and say is it's got to have to do with the streaming business itself, and that is what they are promoting. Yep. So they're betting big on that, and you do see more and more content showing up in Amazon Prime.
Yeah, it's definitely a really naked power play for the streaming market, but just I'm amazed to see just be like, boom.
It does seem a bit, cutting off your nose to spite your face, because if you think about the impacts of this, Amazon is willing to stop selling Apple TV and Chromecast. What about if they said, Netflix, you're using our AWS cloud, but you're now competing with our product, get off our cloud.
Right.
Or if you're an enterprise company and you're selling something that Amazon decides to start selling, does that mean they can kick you off their AWS cloud? Or So that's one side of it. Second side of it is loyalty, customer loyalty. So a lot of people go to Amazon and they'll just buy it from Amazon because it's convenient. Click a button, turns up on your doorstep within 48 hours, or they've got Amazon Prime. Is Amazon Prime really that not – is if it's that unattractive that you have to force people to buy the Amazon thingamy that plays the Amazon Prime content, well, why didn't Amazon just make an app and say, we'll give it to anybody, just take our Prime? The numbers don't seem
that's
like
that. My take. That's where Amazon, I think, is really missing the boat here. I mean, they've got the app that works on Roku. Guys, build the app and put it on Apple TV and stop dicking around. You're kidding yourself here if you think you're going to – I mean, people can go right to the Apple Store and buy the Apple TV. Yeah. All you're doing is making it inconvenient and building up bad will amongst consumers that like you for the convenience of it.
Right.
They're not winning any battles here, I don't think.
And it's not like there's an unlimited number of HDMI ports on the back of your TV.
That's right. So I could have one of each.
Yeah, like if you want to have one of these devices, you really are only going to have one. Most TVs only have one, maybe two HDMI ports at most. It's not like you can have an Apple TV and a Chromecast. And it's not like you can chain them together so you can have all of them at once, like a SCART port used to be. So it does seem...
Yeah, you can, but then you get into home theater. My setup at home is I've got a bunch of HDMI ports on the home theater and then one that goes up to the TV, but I don't think that's most people.
Who'd want that? Most people are.
Oh, I do, because I have surround sound and it's wonderful.
Home theater nerd.
Just doesn't seem to ring true, does it? But it does sort of stink a bit of like if I was using AWS and they were producing a competitive, like they've already knocked off several startups by stealing their business models by database as a service, DNS as a service, storage as a service, cold storage as a service. Each one of these products.
Trying to be one-stop shop,
Each one of those products killed off a company that was using AWS's platform to build a business. I wonder if the market will continue to see Amazon as a platform or as a competitor, and that might be a key point.
They're clearly willing to make naked power plays, so... All right, we're going to keep an eye on the story, see if Amazon decides to walk it back or double down. But that brings us to the end of the show for this week. Greg, where can folks find you if they want to hear more from you?
People can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on my newsletter, Human Infrastructure Newsletter, which you can find at etherealmind.com. There's a link on the homepage where you can go and sign up for that. I'm just busily working on issue 17. To tell you all of the links and the latest information and some of my thoughts that I probably can't publish, but I'll send them to you in an email.
Greg can say worse things in print than he can on a podcast. Ethan, how about you? Where can folks find you?
At EC Banks on Twitter. EthanCBanks.com is my blog. A lot of you do find me on LinkedIn, and if you're a listener and just want to follow whatever I'm saying on LinkedIn, I'd be happy to make a connection with you there. And I also have a newsletter called The Hot Aisle, which you can go to EthanCBanks.com and sign up for that.
And I'm Drew Conry Murray. You can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM. You can see my blogs on packetpushers.net. And as always, you can join us for Network Break. Thanks to this week's sponsor, Riverbed. Your work, your business, your productivity, they all depend on the performance of your applications. So let Riverbed accelerate your software-driven enterprise. And as always, Network Break is powered by Virtual Donuts. The donuts are virtual. The caffeine is very real.